We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast for Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpis. Today's guest is Dr. Molly Maloof. She's the author of a new book called The Spark Factor, The Secret to Supercharging Energy, Becoming Resilient, and Feeling Better Than Ever. In our interview, she shares her research and insights on women's health and well-being. I found her book to be like an encyclopedia chock full of information and data related to our brains, gut, mental, and physical health. She's passionate about biohacking, lifestyle interventions, personalized medicine, and optimizing performance. It's a rich look at how we can manage our own health. Now, here's Dr. Molly. Dr. Molly, welcome to Untangle. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So you start off your book by talking about the human energy crisis. And I liked what you said about this. There is a spark of life inside of each of your cells that powers your body like electricity, but we're crushed by chronic stress. Our spark dims as life goes on. And your book is about reigniting this spark.
Yeah.
There's so much in this book. And before we started the interview, I told you, I think it's like an encyclopedia for women on wellness. But will you talk about what inspired you to write the book? And what is the work that you're doing now that has given you the impetus to talk about these things?
I would say that my entire life, I've been trying to figure out why is it that people get sick and how do you become healthy?
It's a big question.
This is a big question about existence, right? It's a core question of how we thrive in a world, right?
Yes.
So I've always been interested in first principles thinking, which is like looking underneath the surface under the biggest whys of existence. And that led me to becoming a doctor. And as I became a doctor, I was like, okay, this system we've built is a really great system for emergencies, for like really acute emergencies. But the thing that really drove me crazy about working in the hospital, and I'd worked in hospital since I was in ninth grade, so it's been a lot of hospital time. And I always felt like there was something really missed in the big picture. And that was that 80% of the diseases I was seeing were preventable. And so I was like, okay, why is it that these top four big diseases that kill us, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, dementia, why is it, and by the way, alongside diabetes is kidney failure. We've done such a good job in society to increase hygiene, to increase sanitation, to increase vaccinations. We had antibiotics. So we really stopped seeing as many deaths from infectious disease, although there's certainly a lot of people who die from sepsis every year in the hospital. And there's certainly people who die from things like COVID and the flu. But it's a lot less than it was 200 years ago. We've made major strides in infectious disease. But life has changed. And so now what we're seeing is people are dying from metabolic diseases. People are dying from cancer, diabetes, heart disease, dementia. And I was like, why is it that all these conditions seem to have similar risk factors? Stress, eating too much, eating the wrong foods, not moving your body, social disconnection. There seems to be a similar issue that runs through all of them. And no, not all of cancers are due to lifestyle, but a good half of them at a very minimum are probably due to lifestyle. And the vast majority of heart disease and almost all diabetes. There's obviously latent adult diabetes, which is an autoimmune type of diabetes. But in general, what I'm speaking to is the metabolic causes of death, metabolic causes of chronic disease. This is what I was trying to understand. And I was really obsessed with food first because food is obviously a problem in our country. And I think food is probably one of the biggest drivers of this energy crisis. And if you've looked at what we're eating, it's changed dramatically in the last 50 years. But while I was teaching at Stanford, came across some interesting research around relationships and longevity. And I started really looking at my clients and started looking at life itself and wondered, why is it that people who live longer often have healthier relationships than people who have really poor quality relationships? And so I was really interested in how relationships are a lever in reducing stress or creating stress in human existence. And that's really something that got me thinking. And so basically what I've committed my life to is understanding what is health, why do we get sick, and what is this biological imperative underneath our behavior that programs us to do certain things. So the biological imperative is really about survival and reproduction. And whether you have kids or not, whether what you create is people or companies or architecture or art, we have this creative force as humans inside of us. And we also have this survival drive. And it seems like the two biggest levers for optimizing longevity are our food and our relationships. What I break down in this book is basically the four big pillars of health. So it's metabolism, movement, mastering stress, and maintaining connection. And within stress, I would also put sleep, because sleep is really our recovery from stress. I specifically think a lot about these four pillars, but when I was specifically thinking about my life personally, I was interested in food and relationships. When it comes to the book and when it comes to health in general, the biggest drivers, if you actually look at movement, movement creates life, and the people, the longest lived humans have the highest VO2 max. They move their bodies consistently, and movement creates mitochondria. So movement creates a signal to create more energy. And so if you don't move your body, you're basically going to have less energy to do everything. I definitely consider these all extraordinarily important for longevity. That being said, if you eat garbage all day long, it is going to degrade your health. And I'd say that the biggest things that have changed in society in the last 100 years, we've begun moving our bodies a lot less. We've become very much an overworked society. We're sleeping less than we should. We're eating more than we should. And we're stressing out because we're disconnected. And so those are the big things that I want this book to communicate to people, is these are the biggest drivers of health and longevity.
You just brought up two terms that people may or may not know about, and you keep referring to metabolic causes. So I wanted you to define what you mean by metabolic causes. And the book is so much about mitochondria and mitochondrial dysfunction, and I'm not sure that people understand. I mean, we all hear about microbiome and the good bacteria and short-chain fatty acids and all of that, but talk a little bit about these metabolic causes and what is mitochondria and why it's so important inside of our cells.
So mitochondria are the batteries and capacitors in our cells, what are basically power plants, but they're also general contractors. So they're literally deciding where the energy goes and what it's going to go towards. So your microbiome and your mitochondria have a lot of crosstalk, by the way, because they both play a very large role in metabolism. So you can't have a normal metabolism if you have a dysbiotic gut. If your gut is all dysfunctional, it's going to be really hard for you to get enough nutrients into your body. You may have inflammation, you may have leaky gut. You may have food intolerances. So you can't really ignore the gut. And I do talk about the gut in the book quite extensively under the metabolism chapter. But what I really wanted people to understand is that metabolism is largely due to how you consume food, what you consume, and how your little engines, your cells, those little mitochondrial motors, how do they absorb the fuel and use the fuel to create energy? And so when these things break, and they break for a variety of reasons, they break when you put too much fuel into them. They break when you put the wrong fuel into them. They break when you don't use the fuel. When you sit a car in a garage and you turn it on and it doesn't go anywhere, it creates exhaust. And too much exhaust will basically kill you slowly. And that's what's happening when people don't move their bodies and they eat a lot of food. They're basically got a car in the garage and the exhaust is building up and it's poisoning their cells. That's too much reactive oxygen species. Now, we need a little bit because it actually is a signaling molecule, but we don't need a lot. And the problem is most people are producing way too much exhaust. And they're also overheating their engines, which is what I describe inflammation to be like. And inflammation is like an alarm signal. It's like your engine light's going on and there's something going on with the engine and it needs to be looked at. But instead, most people, they don't pay attention. And then the most interesting thing that people don't realize about mitochondria is that they're also transducing all of these signals in your body that you're receiving from your senses and the outside world and the inside world. And they're also creating stress hormones. They're creating sex hormones. And they're literally deciding whether or not you're in a state of fertility and reproduction or in a state of stress and survival. And so this is something that's not really talked a lot about, but the mitochondria play a major role in the stress response. And so when your body is stressed out, it's actually really hard for you to lose weight, because your body is going to hold on to every single calorie because it thinks it's under threat. Stress, whether it's real from a major natural disaster or from psychological stress, your body interprets it the same. It's danger. And so your body will actually change its metabolism if it feels under threat. And that is part of the reason why women in particular struggle with weight loss when they're stressed out.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You just mentioned how important it is for us to have a functional gut. How do people know that everything is functioning properly? And what part of this is genetic? Or do you believe that most things with the gut are solvable through lifestyle changes? But what is a functional gut? How do we define that?
So first and foremost, genetics probably determines about maybe 10 to 20% of your longevity. But a lot of your gut microbiome was literally programmed at birth from your birth canal of your mom. So if you were like me and you had a traumatic birth or a C-section, a long time ago, they didn't know that the microbiome was so important to overall gut health. This was pretty new research in the last 30 years. So now when people have C-sections, they take the mother's vaginal secretions and they put it all over the baby's mouth because you want to get that dose of microbes. But I didn't get that dose. And so me and a lot of other people got antibiotics as a child. And so basically, I just got a crappy start when it comes to my microbiome. So I have always battled gut issues since I was a child. Anyone who had repeated amounts of antibiotics as a child also created the conditions where they didn't get a great microbiome start. And so I wouldn't consider the microbiome something that's really genetic as much as it's programmed by your environment and by your mother. And so basically, you can change your microbiome. There are people who get stool transplants. There are people who take probiotics. And if you take the right probiotics, and there are many good ones out there nowadays, you can actually make a difference in your gut health. But it's actually really important that you move your body consistently, because movement actually plays a major role in gut microbiome diversity. But also diversity of food plays a major role in microbiome diversity. So you want to change up what you're eating in terms of diversity of fruits and vegetables. You want to get local produce because you want to get that local microbiome. And you also want to make sure that you get enough cardiovascular exercise, because that's also important to the microbiome itself. If you want some like objective measures, first and foremost, it's not normal to have constipation or diarrhea consistently. And I consider irritable bowel syndrome to be gut dysfunction until proven otherwise. Obviously, there's a lot of people who consider there's a psychosomatic role in gut health, but the stress response also changes the digestion response. So like when you are stressed and you're not chewing your food properly, you're also creating the conditions where you're not digesting your food properly. And so you can also reduce different digestive juices output. So you may not get enough HDL output. You may not get enough enzyme output. And so that's why I am a big fan of digestive enzymes. It's one of those things that I thought was this random functional medicine woo-woo crap when I was younger. And then I discovered the work by this doctor, Joseph Gonzalez, who's no longer with us, but his work on enzymes was pretty groundbreaking. And I discovered the company BioOptimizers, and they have an incredible team of researchers who produce some of the best probiotics and enzymes in the world. And I just noticed a major shift in my gut health when I was using enzymes versus when I wasn't. So I'm a big fan of enzymes. Another thing that you can do for your gut is just not eating all the time, giving some space in between your meals allows that migrating motor complex to turn on. But if you eat all day long and you're snacking all day long, that migrating motor complex doesn't work as well. So things slow down, and that increases your risk of things like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Another thing that is not normal is it's just not normal to have indigestion. It's not normal to have GERD. And most doctors will just put you on an antacid, but really you need to ask yourself, why do you have GERD in the first place? And I found that a lot of my clients who've had GERD actually had bacterial overgrowth, and that was actually their issue that was causing the GERD. So I think there's also a lot of people who don't realize that ulcers are not normal and H. pylori should be checked for. I've had a fair number of people who've had inflammatory bowel conditions, and those are obviously very serious that you really need to take a look at because they can lead to all sorts of really big problems like fistulas and cancer. Blood in your stool, not normal. A lot of people have hemorrhoids, but a lot of people have polyps that they don't know about or AV malformations. So this is why I like a stool study on people. Just because it's nice to get some objective data on what's going on inside the gut. A lot of people have yeast overgrowth, especially after people have had antibiotics. So that can be a major issue for people. It's really important to get some knowledge on what's going on in your gut. If you have things like indigestion, if you burp a lot, if you have gas, if you have abnormal stool caliber, if it's too thick, too thin, ball-shaped, that's a sign that there can be a problem. So it's always good to look at the Bristol stool scale. And then what else? Color of your stool is also important to look at. It's not normal to have clay colored stools. And then it's not really normal to have pain after eating. I met a young woman recently who had pretty significant pain after she would eat meals. She couldn't really eat very much. And I was like, that's pretty bad gut dysfunction, is to have pain after eating. Turns out that she had diffuse inflammation in her bowel when the doctors did an x-ray and did some imaging studies, actually, I believe. I think they may have done CT. So it's really considered that most doctors just don't really know how to evaluate gut health. They're not taught how to do it.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
That's what I wanted to ask you is, what do you see as the limits of the traditional healthcare system? And for the things that you're just talking about, do most gastroenterologists, when people go, they don't have these information?
They have their own tool set of things to look for pH abnormalities, to diagnose GERD. Obviously, like a stool occult blood to diagnose blood in your stool, a colonoscopy. But they don't really look at all these biomarkers that you can see on a stool study. And that's part of the reason why there's a lot of controversy in the functional medicine world about stool studies. But I have diagnosed a lot of different conditions with stool studies. And I love Genova Diagnostics, and I've always stood by them. I think they're really the gold standard in this space. But the real key is, do you feel normal after meals when you digest food? Do you feel like food is stuck in your gut? Do you feel like it's moving? Do you feel like you have constipation? I had constipation for years when I was young, and no one told me it was abnormal. I had bleeding hemorrhoids. I had chronic diarrhea until I found out that I had major intolerance to wheat. Another big thing that a lot of people don't realize they have is food intolerances. Just live with chronic inflammation and brain fog. Brain fog is almost always related to things going wrong in the gut. And yet people don't pay attention to it. They think it's just part of life.
So we're talking about the immune system. And right now, so many people have long COVID. What is your thought on the COVID vaccine? And for example, if we're taking a lot of this vaccine, is it hurting our ability to have our immune system strong enough to resist diseases and viruses in the future?
I just don't think we have enough information on these vaccines to make that assessment. I think the bigger issue is we were isolated for a few years and people are now going out and they're going out and about. And also, look, in the last 3 years, even though I am a health expert, I've still seen my heart rate variability go down. And it's a result of the chronic stress that everybody's been under. Everyone has been under chronic stress. Most people have a little bit of PTSD from what just happened. We all went through a world-shifting event, let alone the fact that there's climate disasters happening right and left. There's major political uprisings throughout the world happening. There's a war in the Ukraine. There's a recession coming. There's a lot of different reasons to be stressed. So I would say, rather than point fingers at the vaccine, I think we should all be pointing fingers at the level of stress that we're under, because it's well established, the link between stress and immune system dysfunction. Very well established. Now, how do you know that you are resilient to stress and that you have a stronger immune system than average? Well, how quickly do you bounce back after you get sick? I got COVID and I bounced back fairly quickly. It took me maybe a few weeks, but I did some biohacking, of course, because I'm all about biohacking. I did 5 days of NAD therapy along with some ozone right after I got COVID. And I felt like I was 20 again. I was like, oh my God, I felt amazing. And I was like, this is some next level stuff. These new tools that we have in our toolbox for optimizing mitochondrial health, we didn't have before. I would say that this year would probably be in the top 3 years of my life, most stressful years. And not because it was like a bad year. It was actually a very successful year, but I just accomplished more in 1 year than I think I've done in many years. And I've also moved. I traveled around the world. I raised a bunch of money for my company and I taught at Stanford. So I was doing way more things than a normal person would normally do in 1 year. And I definitely felt my immune system weaken a bit. I did get COVID and I didn't have my third vaccine. And the thing is that I bounced back pretty quickly from it. What's funny, my parents have had 4 vaccines and neither of them have had COVID. So do I distrust or trust the vaccines? I'm kind of on the fence at this point. I went to TED and I saw the woman who was working on the Moderna vaccine speak, and it was a really compelling talk. So I'm not really totally anti-vax. I just got so busy this year that I just didn't prioritize it. I may get the flu vaccine actually, because I'm a little bit concerned about the flu because it's really going around quite badly and a lot of people are suffering. So I'm probably going to go get the flu vaccine, but it's one of those things where it's a personal decision. I really believe in health autonomy. I really believe that people should get to decide for themselves what they want to do with their bodies. And I think that this is something that if that is taken away from us, then we're not really living in a free society. To me, that's the most important thing, is that you make a decision with yourself and with your doctor of what's right for you. And I think too many people throughout the world are being controlled unnecessarily by government. And it just doesn't seem like a fair system in a lot of places. And so that's how I see it. But the thing is, the thing about biohacking and the thing the book is trying to communicate to people, that you got to really figure out how to feel your body and understand where you're at with your health. And it's almost like a constant process of working on your health. You can't just not pay attention to your body. And a lot of people just don't pay attention and they're not really listening to the signals that are coming through their body. And I got a lot of messages in the last few weeks that was like, you have to start making some changes if you want to continue on this path. You got to live the example. Launching a book and running a company and having a practice is just all at once. But the book is almost published. And I've heard from a lot of people that when you're launching a book, it's pretty much guaranteed you're going to be stressed out the few months before it launches, because you're just like, you're the one in charge driving the launch. It's just a whole part of the process. But I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to write this book, because it's been a labor of love. And it is quite a comprehensive book on health.
It is. That's why I was saying it's like an encyclopedia. And what you were just saying about people just generally not being aware and not being able to sense what's going on in their body. In your chapter on quantified self, you discuss how we often live on autopilot, which we talk about a lot on our show, and that biohacking takes our habits off of autopilot. And I wanted you to take a moment. I know you're a biohacker and we talk about biohacking as well, but what is it exactly? I feel like it encompasses so many different things that people often get confused and think it's pretty much out there, but there are a lot of simple things that you can do that encompass the biohacking definition.
Yeah. The first thing I'll say is biohacking is about getting information about your body qualitatively and quantitatively, and then making very specific targeted decisions about improving your health. So it's about actually paying attention, gathering information, and then kind of applying the scientific method to systematically improve your health. And so I specifically work through both the model of functional medicine, but also through mitochondrial health. That's a big, big focus of my health optimization programs for my clients. So for example, I monitor with continuous glucose monitors, my glucose levels. I monitor my stress levels with my wearable or a ring, and also with the wearable, the Polar Heart Strap in the app Hanu Health. I monitor my step count, my exercise. I monitor a lot of different things, and I get my labs done probably every 3 to 6 months. And I actually even do MRIs fairly regularly just because I want to see what's going on inside my body. And this is what I would call biohacking. It's taking data, taking information, and then basically being able to take action on the information. So if I see my vitamin D levels are down, then I take more vitamin D. If I see that my magnesium levels are low and I'm feeling tense, then I order more magnesium. If I'm noticing I'm not digesting as easily, I'll take more digestive enzymes. So it's supplementation, it's wearable technology, it's even things like red light therapy. I just got this cool light from Vital Red Light, and it's your mitochondria are light sensitive. So you can actually put these lights on and sit in front of them and just start to charge your body. I also use things like PEMF mats as a human body charger. I use infrared mats. I use sauna blankets. I'm using all these tools to improve my health and improve my mitochondrial function.
Are there two or three tools for people that aren't going to probably buy all of these items? Are there two or three that you think are?
The big one is that 1 in 3 people have prediabetes, which means 1 in 3 people have insulin resistance. And insulin resistance precedes chronic metabolic disease. And so you want to find out if you're insulin resistant sooner than later. And so I would say getting a fasting insulin test at your doctor, if it's above 9, you are pretty much guaranteed to be insulin resistant. That means your insulin levels are going up higher than they should be. And your body's literally adapting to the diet that you're consuming by pumping out more insulin. And then I would also put a glucose monitor on. I use the app Levels, and you can use my code Dr. Molly to get access to Levels. But I'm a big fan of wearing a CGM because I really think that continuous glucose monitoring is one of the best ways to identify your fasting blood sugar and your post-meal blood sugar. And it's just such an important tool that we didn't have. And I was pioneering this in 2014, and I was borderline pre-diabetic. And so if 1 in 3 people have pre-diabetes and 80% of them don't know it, that is millions of people out there who have no idea that they're on their way to getting hypertension, high cholesterol, high blood sugar, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and dementia. And you got to catch it early, because if you catch it early, you can do something about it. You can totally reverse it. It's 100% reversible in early stages. When you have late stage diabetes, basically once you hit diabetes, you've lost about 60% of your beta cell function, which means that you've lost more organ reserve in your pancreas that it can't keep up with your diet. Now, if you have prediabetes, you've lost about 40% of your beta cell function. And so you're actually on your way to actually losing a significant ability to maintain a normal blood sugar level. So that's why it's so important to get these things checked.
There's so much controversy over nutrition these days. And in your book, you say, of course, there is some universal truth, but it's also very personal. How do we know which nutrition guidelines we should follow for ourselves? The mix of universal truths versus what's personal for us.
Yeah. The first thing I'm going to say is that there's a lot of dietary dogma out there. And one of the big problems with that dogma is that people believe that, oh, I found the diet that works for me, which means this is the diet that works for everyone. And people will just go so hard into veganism, or they'll go so deeply into the ketogenic or the carnivore diet. And I think it's really unfortunate in general, because people don't have the same bodies and metabolisms. And so it's going to take some trial and error to figure out what works for you. And you got to really listen to your body when you're trying these different dietary styles to find out what works. But the one thing that I know for sure works is not eating fast food, ultra processed foods, and lots of sugar and refined carbs.
Those are the universal truths.
If you're a serious athlete, like I have friends that are marathon runners and they run triathlons and they literally have drank soda during their marathons. They're literally burning straight sugar. They're running. They're using the fuel. Now, most people should not be touching soda almost ever. It's just not at all healthy whatsoever. And I would also just say that the vast majority of people eat way too much sugar, and the vast majority of people are not really watching the sources of vegetable oil they're consuming. And a lot of vegetable oil in our diets is actually rancid. And it's not like I'm across the board like, oh, vegetable oil is evil, because there's a lot of health influencers that are just like, seed oils are going to kill you. And it's actually, no, it's not that simple. It's that rancid seed oils are oxidized and are inflammatory, and they're just not good for the body. But that's really comes in the form of fried food. And when you eat chips and you eat fried packaged processed foods, those are fried. When you eat food that comes in a McDonald's bag, that's usually fried. The worst thing you can eat is soda, fries, and a burger. That's not healthy. The vast majority of what people are consuming are processed foods, fast foods, ultra-processed foods. These are what are eliminated in vegan diets and typically keto diets. And so if you just first and foremost just eliminate these things from your diet and start with whole foods, that's the first step to personalizing your diet. It's just, let's take out the garbage. And then let's bring in the things that are actually good for you. I eat pretty much only whole foods. And that's just my personal preference, but I've noticed a major improvement in my health by just eating whole foods. Now, I like to eat less refined carbs, and I don't eat a lot of grains and legumes, although I do eat some legumes. Like I like lentils. I do eat some beans, some chickpeas. I don't do a lot of grain. My body just seems to not feel awesome when I do a lot of grain. I do some quinoa here and there, but whether you tolerate grains or not, or beans or not, will probably be due to whether or not you have any autoimmunity. So I probably have celiac given how horribly I respond to wheat. I just get really sick for like a whole week. I'm really ill. I can't eat wheat. So I have to be really careful with grain. And one of the bigger problems with grain in our diet is the glyphosate exposure. So a lot of oats, a lot of just mainstream grain products, unless you're buying organic ancient grains that are whole kernel grains that you know where they're sourced, a lot of grains have glyphosate. And so you got to be aware of that. There's a lot of problems with that because it can cause really big problems in your gut health. So a lot of people notice when they eat grains in other countries, they do fine. And then they come to America and they don't. And so I went to Guatemala and I ate corn and it didn't seem to bother me as much. And I found out that there was a lot of controversies in Guatemala because a lot of these big food companies tried to bring in their hybridized GMO corn, and the country, literally the farmers revolted. And they really value corn as part of their culture. And so these ancient forms of corn, and even I would say even the ancient forms of potatoes in countries like Peru and in South America, they just have a different food quality than the stuff that we're getting in America. I also just am a big believer in local food, but fundamentally, you got to find out what works for your body. I'm not anti-red meat. I definitely don't try to eat. I really try to avoid processed meat as much as possible. But some people really do thrive on a vegan diet. I have a lot of friends that do really well on vegan diets. And I'm not saying vegan diets don't work for people. Some people thrive on more ancestral diets. Typically, the way I see it is the people who are naturally bigger boned, naturally more heavy set, seem to do better on lower carb, more ancestral diets. People who seem to be leaner naturally seem to do better with higher carbs. They can just tolerate them more effectively. If you put a blood sugar monitor on, you will literally see how your body metabolizes carbs in real time. You can see if what you're eating is causing big, major blood sugar spikes, or if you have a really nice, consistent blood sugar. My friends who are vegan, who eat high carb diets, they do fine with their blood sugar. And then I have friends who, I've actually met quite a lot of women lately that are pretty high powered, and they put a blood sugar monitor on and they are basically very pre-diabetic. And they said, Molly, if it wasn't for you and putting this blood sugar monitor on, I would never have known that I had this problem. So I like to put blood sugar monitors on just because it can help you identify, are you digesting carbs properly? Are you metabolizing them too fast and actually raising your blood sugar too fast? And so it's really a matter of looking at the data and then looking at your blood labs. If you can see in your blood labs, if you need more B vitamins, you can see if you need more B12, you can see if you need more magnesium, you can see if you need more omega-3s, you can see if you need more iron. So I look at ferritin, OmegaCheck, I look at fasting insulin, fasting glucose. I look at hemoglobin A1C. I look at triglycerides. Those last four are all really important for blood sugar. And then I also look at blood fats. So I look at the NMR lipoprotein profile. I want to see, do you have a healthy LDL pattern A, or do you have lots and lots of pattern B? Do you have really high particle numbers? Do you have an LPIR score that is indicative of insulin resistance? Do you have normal lipids, or are your lipids crazy? In some cases, you will want to look at the kind of fats that you're consuming. I do eat saturated fat, but I try not to make it more than 15% of my diet. Ideally, hunters and gatherers and even French people, their diets are between 10 and 15% saturated fats. Most countries' guidelines recommend less than 10%, but most Americans are eating over 20%. So saturated fat is not evil, but when you combine it with refined carbs, it becomes particularly problematic for metabolism.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
I want to ask 2 questions related to what you've just been saying, but not exactly in a linear way, but carbs are important for fiber and also for resistant starch. And a lot of the data says that eating white potatoes and white rice, cooling them and then eating them, even if you reheat them, is really good for your gut microbiome because it becomes a resistant starch when it cools. Do you agree with that? Is that true for everyone? The idea of having more fiber and resistant starch from things that we might think we should have brown rice or sweet potatoes?
I just want to point out that I don't want to demonize any food aside from trans fats and maybe all the processed crap that's in our diet. Cheetos are delicious, but they are terrible for your health. They're filled with artificial colors. They're filled with glyphosate-ridden corn. They're filled with fried vegetable oils. Fried chips are probably not, they're just not good for you. But when it comes to potatoes and rice, these are pretty fundamental food groups for a lot of people in the world. And so you can't just demonize them. But you got to find out how you're metabolizing them. So put a glucose monitor on. You got to find out the dose that you can consume. There's basically a secret hack that you can do when it comes to refined carbs like white rice and white potatoes, which I wouldn't necessarily call refined carbs, but they are white carbs. And that's that you can eat them last. So if you eat your vegetables first, your green vegetables, your non-starchy vegetables first, your protein second, and your carbs last, you can actually greatly reduce the glycemic impact. And then if you have apple cider vinegar before meals, you can also greatly reduce the glycemic impact significantly. So you can just literally change your metabolism by cooking and cooling and eating them last and combining them with things like ACV. So that's one cool thing that you can do. So it doesn't mean you can't have them. It just means you got to be careful. Now, when I eat sushi, and if I eat really cheap sushi, it's like kind of sweet rice. They've added a lot of sugar to it. It'll spike my blood sugar. So I definitely know that I don't eat a lot of white rice and I don't eat a lot of potatoes, but I do eat them sometimes. I'm not going to completely give them up.
And would you suggest that people completely give up salt, or do you think that's also variable?
I think the issue with salt is that it really depends on if you have pre-existing hypertension or pre-hypertension. And personally, I don't get enough salt. My sodium tends to run lower. So I actually like to salt my food, but a lot of people's salt sources come from processed foods and canned foods and frozen. And so that's really the bigger issue, is where you're getting your salt. Fast food is very salty. So people, even restaurants, add a lot of salt to make food taste good. So I'm not against salt, but I definitely think that really important that you ideally cook your own food and salt your own food.
I 100% agree. So I want to move on to your favorite brain hacks. As I was reading your book, I went onto Amazon and bought NAC.
Oh, yeah.
But what are your favorite brain supplements for people who are really thinking about brain age and brain health?
NAC is specifically a detoxifying supplement that is great if you live in big cities, you're exposed to a lot of pollution. It's also what they use in hospitals for Tylenol poisoning. And anybody who drinks should be taking that. But it's a controversial supplement because would I recommend it for brain health? If toxicity is a source of brain dysfunction for you, then yes. If you have heavy metals, yes, because heavy metals can cause brain dysfunction. But I would say for brain health, I like different nootropics and different things that are really just in my kitchen. So first and foremost, you got to figure out what's the source of your brain dysfunction. So I would recommend the Braverman assessment. It's called the Braverman assessment or the Mood Cure book. And this will help you identify which supplements are best for your brain based on neurotransmitter system problems. So I tend to have minor memory issues and I love to boost my acetylcholine levels with supplements like CT-choline or uridine. I also love lion's mane, which is great for neuroplasticity and BDNF production. I'm also a big fan of, what else? Spirulina, chlorella, blue algae for mitochondrial health. It's got SOD in it, SOD, which is a natural antioxidant. It's just a great tool, the toolbox for optimizing mitochondria. Things like PQQ, Q10, ALA. I would say those are like the big ones for mitochondrial health, as well as Alcar. Some people really like Alcar for mitochondrial function. So that if energy is the issue for you and mitochondrial issues, and you just don't have enough energy, then I would look at the mitochondrial supplementation. But there's so many tools in the toolbox in the nootropics world. So it's really a tricky thing to really work through because you got to have an assessment before you know what to take.
It is really tricky because you may feel fatigue or you may have gut problems, and I don't think most people want to take 10 to 15 different supplements every day. And
I mean, the big ones that I take the most consistently are maca, lion's mane, and I pretty much always take acetylcholine. And I experiment with different nootropics, but I'm also just a big believer, honestly, in omega-3s. So I take a lot of omegas every day, 4 grams a day of really highly refined pharmaceutical grade omegas from Norway. There's a company that you can get in Norway called NPure 3. They're not available in America yet, but they are the best in the world. You can also get a prescription of Lavasa from your doctor. And I've definitely noticed a difference in my brain function with omegas. It's hugely impactful. So I would say that most people don't realize how much stress they're under. And coffee is great when you're not under a lot of stress because it's basically a cup of a little bit of stress. But it definitely can be problematic if you're under lots of stress. I have a coffee detox program that I designed for Mudwater. You can sign up for free on Mudwater's website. And it's a fantastic program for basically just getting off of coffee. And I drink Mudwater instead. And not because they're paying me to say this. I genuinely can't drink coffee right now because my cortisol levels are too high. So when I start noticing, I mean, I use the Dutch test to identify hormone imbalances. And when I saw my cortisol levels were pretty crazy this year, I was like, you know what? Time to course correct. And if you have data, you can change your lifestyle. So I stopped doing as much intense exercise in the gym. I started really easing up on cold plunges. I stopped drinking coffee. I started sleeping more. I started meditating more. I meditated for an hour today. I just feel so much better when I meditate.
Okay, let's talk about meditation. I was going to ask you about fasting, but since you mentioned meditation, let's talk about that because we talk about that within the context of so many different themes and topics. And you talk about recovery through mindfulness, breathing exercises, and meditation. And I'd love to hear about your practices and also what you recommend for your high performers and for anyone that comes into your office.
First and foremost, I would say that meditation and mindfulness is the cheapest, freest medicine in the world. It's just so widely available to get trained on how to become a meditator. It's literally unending resources at your fingertips on the internet. There's guided meditations on YouTube. There's apps for free. And yet it's very underutilized. And part of that is because, and by the way, I'm super guilty of this. We are all so busy. And I have these friends of mine that are so much more enlightened than I am. And when I spend time with them, they tell me about their routines. And they're like, yeah, I meditated 2 hours today. And I was like, what? How did you have time for that? And they're like, Molly, you don't have time not to. And I was like, whoa, way to really stick it to me. Because the truth is that meditation is medicine. And it widens the space between perception and reaction. It really reduces the stress response directly. It gets your entire body in a state of relaxation. And it just requires to sit on a cushion and be still. And notice your thoughts and to breathe. And that is hard. And I'm not going to say it's not, but it is worth it. And as someone who goes off and on with meditation, I'm just a better person when I'm meditating. I just am a genuinely better human being. And the thing is that I'm also a flawed human. We're all flawed. We all are not perfect, sadly. But it's almost like you got to take your medicine. If you don't take your medicine, you're going to have mental health problems. And the world that we're living in today, I would say that it's widespread causing mental dysfunction in people, like widespread. And I'm talking people who I know who have mental illness are getting worse. People who don't have mental illness are having major stress responses that are out of proportion to what's going on in their lives. And it's because of this chronic stress that's been building up for the last 3 years. We all feel like we're under constant threat with the news. There's a mass shooting every week. Let's get real. The world's not safe. We don't feel safe anymore in our environment. So one of the definite things that you can do to change the stress response is to sit on your mat or sit on your cushion and consciously return to your breath and consciously create a centered perspective. And breathing is your biggest lever for handling whatever comes towards you. And yet we always forget to breathe, especially when we're under the most stress. We just forget how powerful the breath is. So I'm a big believer in meditation and breath work. And I just think most of us could actually use more mindfulness. We all need more. I personally just realize if I don't consistently meditate, it's so easy to have your thoughts race first thing you do when you wake up in the morning. And that just sets the tenor of your whole day. It literally creates the entire tone of the rest of your day. So I've been on maybe 4 meditation retreats in the last few years, and it's such an awesome way to reset your body and your brain.
Yeah, I'm 100% in agreement. I love meditation retreats. I love being in silence for several days in a row, and I do feel like a new person afterwards. I think you're speaking to some believers on this one. I want to just ask you one more question. Well, it's really 2 questions, actually, before we close. One is about intermittent fasting, because I know it's very controversial now. And I'm wondering if you stop eating at 7 in the evening and don't eat breakfast till 7 in the morning, is that considered, because it's 12 hours intermittent fasting? And then the second question, unrelated, but I'll let you go on about this, is how much protein? Does everybody need the same amount of protein per meal? And I think in your book, you talk about a protein-rich breakfast and that being really important. But how much protein do we need per meal?
I would say that the average person who's weightlifting consistently needs about 1.6 grams per kilogram. If you're running and doing a cardio exercise and you're like a real serious competitive cardiovascular athlete, you probably need 1.7. If you're over 65, the very minimum is 1.2 grams per kilogram. And so in my book, I outline the recommendations are basically that we would only need 0.7 grams per kilogram per day. But we actually need more, like double that. So it's pretty crazy that the government recommends so little when there's such abundant evidence at this point that if we don't get enough protein, then our muscles will waste and we get sarcopenia as we age.
And then what do you think about intermittent fasting?
Okay, so this is really controversial right now. There's this huge argument around continuous calorie restriction versus intermittent fasting. And it's looking like they're both pretty much equal in efficacy for weight loss. There may be less hunger for people who just do normal calorie restriction. And there may be some benefits for blood pressure with just regular calorie restriction versus intermittent fasting. But what we're finding is that for some people, continuous calorie restriction is just really hard for them. And they just find it easier to fast. So like eating earlier in the evening, not eating late at night, and then extending your fast in the morning, eating a later breakfast. Sometimes that works better for people than trying to continuously calorie restrict throughout the day. And it's really just another tool in the toolbox for optimizing health. Now, who should not fast? Well, anybody with an eating disorder, anybody with orthorexia, anybody with anorexia, anybody who's really stressed out should probably just be eating a normal diet and not trying to lose weight, because you're not going to lose weight anyway if you're already stressed out. It's just like good luck. So the key there is just reducing your stress levels. But on top of all this, it's just really important for people to recognize that there's a lot of women I know personally who've made major strides in their health with fasting. I don't think I would have fixed my borderline prediabetes if I hadn't fasted. I think it got my liver totally healthy and I don't have to do as much fasting anymore because my metabolism normalized. But when I was younger, I actually credit fasting, and I did a fair amount of prolonged fasting when I was in the year 2019. I really think it played a role in improving my relationship to my spirituality. Like I had some pretty major breakthroughs. And fasting has been a part of spiritual culture throughout the world in almost every religion. So is fasting good or bad? It really depends on the individual and what their goals are. I wouldn't recommend a lot of fasting for athletes because you don't want to do a lot of fasted exercise. But for women who are older, hitting menopause, fasting can actually be really helpful for maintaining healthy metabolism as they get older. I've got a few women who are perimenopausal who do ProOn, and it's a fasting mimicking diet, and they do great with maintaining their weight using that program. So I think it's particularly helpful for women as they get older and for women who are noticing the weights coming on as they get older. But I don't think it's across the board necessary for optimal health. But I think it is a tool if you have metabolic dysfunction.
Yeah. Molly, there is so much we haven't talked about in your book. I don't think we'd ever have enough time for it. It is so chock full of information. And I have pages and pages of notes here, but I want people to buy the book and put it by their bedside so they can go back to the different chapters. And some of the things in the book are complicated. And I feel like it's excellent information for people to have to manage our health and well-being and not be reliant on a healthcare system that only fixes us when we're broken.
Yeah, I totally agree. You got to take proactive measures in our health. If I hadn't have realized I had borderline prediabetes in my early 30s, I'd probably be pre-diabetic by now.
Right. Of course, there are a ton of things we haven't talked about, but there's anything really key that you think is important for people to take away before we close?
The one thing we didn't talk a lot about was the end of the book, but it's really all about love and longevity. And I just really think that most people don't really fully realize the power of love for health and longevity. When you get sick, who's going to come and be next to your side? And really high quality, healthy relationships is one of the most nourishing things that we can do for ourselves.
I'm so glad you said that. I agree. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm so grateful.
Totally. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. For more on Dr. Molly, check out her book, available at all major booksellers, and her website at drmolly.co. For more on Muse, go to choosemuse.com. Any questions, suggestions, or feedback, send it along at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.